four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story for you. And now here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Congressman Chester Bowles of Connecticut. He recently was chosen as the chairman of the committee which will write the platform for the 1960 campaign. Work on the platform already has begun with a series of regional meetings. Republican leaders this past week opened an attack on the makeup of Congressman Bowles' committee. They said it is dominated by radicals of previous campaigns. Congressman Bowles has been mentioned as a possible dark horse candidate for president, but he has declared his support for Senator John Kennedy. He is serving as an advisor to Senator Kennedy on matters of foreign policy. Congressman Bowles was the wartime administrator of government price controls. He later was elected governor of Connecticut, and he served as our ambassador to India. He was elected to Congress in 1958. His books and articles on both foreign and domestic affairs have been widely quoted. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Congressman Bowles, are Peter Lissagor of the Chicago Daily News, Chalmers Roberts of the Washington Post, John Steele of Time and Life magazines, and Frank Burkholzer of NBC News. Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel, will be back with us next week. Now, Congressman Bowles, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Burkholzer.
Mr. Bowles, if you were foreign policy advisor to a president rather than a candidate, would you advise him in this situation where an American pilot has been shot down by the Russians and is admitted being a spy? Would you advise just admitting that he was a spy as has been done?
You've asked a very tough one. It seems to me that the administration did about all they could with a very, very difficult, very unpleasant, and highly embarrassing situation. It's pretty clear that Mr. Khrushchev knew what was going on, and he appears to have the evidence of which he could confront the world and presumably persuade the world. I think it would have only made a bad situation, and I think it is a very bad situation, worse, if we tried to cover it up.
On the same question, there are a lot of aspects, but I'm wondering particularly what your viewpoint would be, particularly thinking of the upcoming administration. To the point of the president being unaware of such an activity, as apparently is the case in this incident, do you think the president should be kept purposely unaware of certain intelligence operations?
Well, let's start with the fact that I believe this will go down history as probably the most embarrassing, in some ways shocking, occurrence of the last 7 or 8 years. It's terribly embarrassing, difficult. It's put us in a very bad situation before the world. We're going to hear a lot more of it. I wish I were talking about it 2 or 3 days from now, where perhaps we'd have a better chance to settle down and think it through. And certainly anything I say I want to have be sure is very responsible and thoughtful, because no one has any desire to make this worse, certainly not for partisan reasons. But it seems to me the whole situation has placed the State Department in the position of having deliberately told a falsehood. We assume they did not know the actual facts, that these facts are simply given them. As you go on to say, the president himself was placed in a position of not appearing to know a very major development in regard to our foreign policy. The Soviet Union were encouraged to be suspicious of us, and they were already very suspicious, on this whole matter of controls, inspection. They've always charged that the reason we want this inspection is for spying work and espionage generally. They also have been granted a beautiful opportunity to use this, and they'll use it certainly very adroitly, to embarrass us and to weaken our already weak position as we approach the summit. And the whole world has been given a very deep contrast between our apparent desire for peace, our desire to try to negotiate a peace, while carrying on this kind of activity almost simultaneously. I think it's a very bad situation.
Mr. Steele.
Mr. Bowles, I want to get one thing straight. Are you criticizing the activities of the plane, or are you criticizing the pilot getting caught?
Well, let me say this, that I don't think any one of us, as simply an outsider and a newspaper reader as I am, can know what is essential here in the way of espionage. We all are realists. We all know that this is a difficult and complex world. We know we're at a disadvantage. That the Soviet, as a closed police state, has certain very great advantages over us. However, it seems to me that that's not really the point here. The point is the timing. This may be necessary in certain circumstances, depending, of course, on the technical problems of how great our lack of knowledge really is. But the point is we are preparing for a summit meeting. The whole history of the world may depend on our ability to negotiate with the Soviet Union, to talk with them on a basis of mutual trust, or at least some greater degree of mutual trust. By timing this particular excursion at this particular time, we have certainly gone a long way to undermine that hope.
Well, now let's see if I understand. You mean these activities are all right except when we have an international meeting, is that correct?
I don't know that they're all right at all, Mr. Steele, because I don't know the inside story of how much information we have, what we lack, or what risk should be required to get it. I would assume that we should not do this sort of thing for a marginal gain. Only if the gain was so very, very vital to our security that it could be justified on the basis of our national security, the utmost degree. But the point is that here we are in a very delicate position, and certainly this would be a time to be far more circumspect than obviously these people have been. I think they've committed a very gross case of misjudgment, and I think it's highly reckless, and I think it's dangerous and hurtful.
Mr. Bowles, you are the foreign policy advisor to Senator Kennedy and presumably
right.
will become his Secretary of State if he's elected president.
I wouldn't presume now, that for one minute.
You would not presume.
No.
Well, nevertheless,
There'll be lots of possibilities.
There has been talk of keeping the candidates informed about developments in foreign policy. Have you been kept informed as to these flights, either as Senator Kennedy's foreign policy advisor, as a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee?
No, I've not heard of them. I've not been kept advised in any way, and I doubt that he has. I'm very sure that none of us have.
Mr. Roberts.
Congressman, I'd like to turn to politics for a minute. Everybody says you're a dark horse in the Democratic outlook. It seems apparent that the convention, or possible that the convention may be deadlocked in Los Angeles for some time. If that happens, and if there was a turn to you as a possible compromise candidate, would you accept?
Well, I think this talk of my being a dark horse is rather far-fetched. I'm grateful for the friends I've had around the country who've advanced it, and I've been flattered by it, and naturally it's pleasant to know that what I've been trying to say over a long period of years is at least taken hold with some people. However, I've never taken it seriously. I've done all I can to discourage it. I'm for Jack Kennedy, first, last, and always. I'm sticking right thoroughly with him, and I think he's going to get nominated.
Well, as you would say if I was the witness on the Hill, that's not a responsive answer. Can't you tell me yes or no?
I think
if
the question
drafted,
is,
would you accept?
It's such an impossible situation, I can't even visualize it.
Mr.
Roosevelt, I was brought up under FDR. He said never answer questions that have that much if in them.
Well, let
They're
me
too
turn
far
it,
and too remote.
Let me turn it around the other way. Will you make a Sherman statement that you wouldn't accept it if it were offered?
I think I'd look very silly and presumptuous if I did.
Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. Bowles, I'd like to ask you in connection with an earlier question. Do you think the Democrats ought to be kept informed on basic foreign policy developments, specifically on the nuclear test suspension talks? Now, won't the Senate have to ratify any treaty we might agree to? And do you think the Senate members, the Democratic members, the important ones, are being taken into those councils sufficiently?
No, I don't. I think it's very bad. Let's go back to 1918. In October 1918, Woodrow Wilson made a very partisan appeal for a election of a Democratic Congress. He got instead a Republican Congress, elected in the by-election, the off-year election of 1918. He then left 3 weeks later for the peace conference in Paris, taking with him only one Republican who was so far down the line Republican circles that people didn't even know he was Republican. And while I'm a tremendous admirer of Mr. Wilson's, and I feel he's one of the really great Americans of all time, I think this was an abysmal political mistake. It led the way to a good deal of the misunderstanding and challenge and difficulty and final frustration in the United States Senate when we failed to get the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations through. I might say that I think this administration is making the self-same error.
Would you say that they ought then to take Democratic senators to the summit conference?
I certainly think they should. I think they ought to be kept more carefully informed. We have not had honest bipartisanship in these last 7 or 8 years. I think it's dangerous not to have it. I think the Democrats, under the circumstances, have behaved with a good deal of responsibility in the absence of real bipartisanship.
On another point, Mr. Bowles, in Milwaukee last night, I believe you made a speech blaming a good deal of Mr. Khrushchev's bitter blast at the United States recently on what you called China and the extreme rightists within the Soviet Union, suggesting, according to the accounts I read, that these people want to torpedo a summit conference. How do you square that kind of a statement with the general belief here in Washington that Mr. Khrushchev needs peace and needs certain relaxation in order to get his 7-year plan to work?
Well, my statement, as it was quoted, and I haven't seen the paper, was not, that wouldn't be quite accurate if that's the way it appeared. What I asked was the question, how much influence have the Chinese had in this situation? How much influence does exist among the old Stalinist regime within the Soviet Union? I asked as a question, I think it's a very proper question, too. The Chinese have always timed a lot of their entrenchments in the Far East, Quemoy and Matsu and the rest, for just the periods when we were beginning to try to negotiate and talk with the Soviet. It's my guess that Mr. Khrushchev would really like to try to develop an easier atmosphere here. I felt this strongly when I saw him and talked with him a little over 3 years ago in Moscow. I had a long 3-hour talk with him, and I came out of it quite convinced that he wanted a detente. He wanted this situation to ease, that he felt the need of it for his own country, but he was highly suspicious and feeling his way. Now, clearly, it would seem to me clearly that this is not to the interest necessarily of the Mao Zedong government in Peking. They naturally want to keep the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States just as active and vigorous as they possibly can, because this assures them a flow of material and loans and all the things they need from the Soviet Union. I would assume that there's quite a clash here, at least a potential clash, between Chinese communist interest and the Kremlin's interest.
But do you not believe that Mr. Khrushchev is secure enough today in Russia so that he can move on toward relaxation if he so chooses at a summit conference?
I don't think we really know. I hope so. I visited Belgrade this November. I wanted to go there to talk to some of the Yugoslavs who often follow pretty much a Soviet line. For instance, in regard to Berlin, their line is almost identical with the Soviet. But they do have some insight into what's going on in the Soviet Union and also in China. And I want to try to probe this question with them. There's a general feeling there that the Mao Zedong's government in Peking had some contacts and some hopes of support for an extreme position from certain elements in the Soviet military. I don't think they knew it for a fact, but they're inclined to feel that this was the case.
Mr. Burkholzer.
I'd like to ask a question, Mr. Bowles, directed to your role as chairman of the platform committee. You've spoken in many of your speeches about the challenge of Soviet economic ability and their production and so on. In translating this into an American program, would you suggest that the Russians have developed the art of economic planning to a point that we should perhaps copy their planning methods?
Mr. Burkholz, I don't think that's necessary. I am concerned about our slow lack of growth. Indeed, if you asked me what I thought was the single most important question before the American people today, it would be our capacity to grow at a much faster rate without inflation, with stable prices. I feel if we can develop our growth rate to around 5% or 4.5% without rising prices, and I think we can, we can do all of these things. We can build up our defenses adequately. We can tackle questions of foreign aid. We can build the schools we need. We can get rid of our slums. We can build this country as a dynamic, positive force it should be in world affairs. And if we don't grow fast enough, we can. Now, I think the interesting thing is this. Soviet Union is growing at about a rate of 7% annually, but so is capitalistic Germany. So is capitalistic Mexico. So is capitalistic Japan. Indeed, I think the average growth rate in Western Europe is around 6%, all under capitalism. There's nothing wrong with our system. It's simply that the system is now in hands of rather timid people who are thinking timidly, and I just don't think I have enough confidence in the dynamism of this economy.
Well, you would say that it doesn't require a greater degree of federal planning than...
I would think that the question of national goals, I think, is related to this, and I would certainly favor this. Mr. Hoover originally suggested it back in 1930, and I've talked about it, and so have many other people since. I think it would be a very good thing to hold hearings every summer, let's say, before a committee or board of very highly respected Americans representing all qualities and areas of our economy, and talk out and plan to see what our goals should be in housing and schools and roads and urban renewal and defense and all these other facets of our economy. But I don't think the plan should have any particular bite to them in the sense of being totalitarian or anything of that kind. I think we simply set the direction in which we like to go and familiarize Congress and the American people fully with where we can go and where we need to go if we're going to do what we have to do in this next 10 years.
Congressman, you're going to have to cover a great many domestic subjects in the platform. I'm wondering to what extent the South is going to be recognized in the drafting of the platform.
Well, the South is certainly going to have its big chance to be heard, as is the East and the West and the North. All sections are. My own views on all these questions are pretty well established. I've written and spoken a lot on them, but I'm simply one member of a 110-man committee and woman.
Well, the next question that comes out of that is, are you ready to risk a walkout of some of the Southern delegates if you write a civil rights plank which is not acceptable to them?
Well, some people have gone so far as to become very annoyed with some of our Democratic brethren to the South and have said, what if they do walk out? Let's do whatever is required even to see that they do walk out. I simply can't accept this. I would like to see this Democratic Party remain a united party. We are the only national party, and I think this is a great advantage. It also carries with it certain problems, because as a national party, our whole difficulty of getting a consensus is obviously much greater. But my guess is that we can work this out. There are lots of good, forward-looking groups of people in the South that I know understand this world we're living in, who believe in the dignity of man and are willing to accept the word of that great Virginian, former governor of Virginia, Thomas Jefferson, who asserted in our Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. I think we can handle this, and I think our Republican friends, I suppose, are hoping we can't. But I'm very confident that we can.
Mr. Steele.
Mr. Bowles, a couple of your Republican friends the other day, Senator Goldwater and Congressman Miller, chairman of the Senate and House Campaign Committee, said that your whole committee was masterminded by a few radicals with leftover ideas. Is this correct?
Well, I saw that, and I was very intrigued because he simply listed the people who have written the various council reports for the advisory committee of the Democratic Party. I know all these people very well. I think they're remarkably fine men. Many of them are my very good friends. I admire them greatly. So here you have definitely guilt by association on my part. But I'd like to call your attention to the fact that on this very day, Mr. Goldwater also teed off against Mr. Eisenhower, who he said was dabbling in socialized medicine, and he also accused Mr. Fleming of going in for a dime store New Deal. So I'm in highly respectable company.
One of the gentlemen from your own state, Senator Bush, on a somewhat different line, had a proposal that each platform plank carry a price tag, how much it was going to cost. You're chairman of the Democratic Platform Committee. Do you think this is a good idea?
I would be delighted to do that. I don't think it's very practical because I don't think we can always tell just what it costs, but I think it's perfectly fine to know what it costs. I also think we ought to know what it costs not to do some of these things. What are our slums costing us today? What is an inadequate military costing us? What is inadequate foreign aid costing us? What is inadequate education costing us? Let's know the cost of not doing things as well as the cost of doing them.
Mr. Roberts.
Congressman, I was reading a magazine article you've written about the China problem recently, and one thing struck me. The man you're supporting, Senator Kennedy, has said publicly that if he were elected, he would do something about ending the American commitment to Kumoi and Matsu, the offshore island. But I noticed you avoided that question or did not mention it. Do you disagree with him on this?
No, I think that we are very wrong to stake the future of our American prestige and strength on two islands just off the coast of China. I also feel it would be a great mistake to get off those islands under fire and under pressure. I think that's the difficulty. Now, when there is no pressure, I would agree that we should try to negotiate our way off them, neutralize them, find some way to neutralize this thumb that we have sort of sticking in the communist eye.
Well, do you expect in the platform this year that for the first time the Democrats will come out in favor of a two-China policy?
Well, I don't know because, of course, I can't speak for this committee, but I do feel very strongly that the recognition question is pretty much a dead-end street. If we could visualize our government calling up Mr. Mao Zedong someday and saying, look, we've decided to recognize you people, I think you'd get a very fast answer back, which would be, do you recognize our sovereignty over the island of Taiwan or Formosa? And we would say, of course not. We'll defend Formosa, as of course we must. I think Mr. Mao Zedong would then hang up the telephone, and that'd be the end of the conversation. So I think our China policy really ought to start with that point. That what we need is a China policy that goes beyond this narrow debate, this rather sterile debate over recognition, and goes to the question of how we can make some contacts with the Chinese people. I think we have something to learn from the question of the Soviet Union. From 1918 to 33, we did not recognize the Soviet Union. We had all kinds of contacts with the Russian people, however. We sent our newspaper men there. Many of them went there. Many Russians came here. Tradesmen and engineers and doctors and people of my universities. And we had contacts with China. I happen to think that China is probably the biggest question, the biggest challenge that we're going to meet in these next 20 years. I think China is inherently aggressive in many of the situations that exist there. It has too little land, too many people, too few resources, and worse still, politically and economically and militarily soft neighbors, which almost invites aggression. Now, we're not coping with this problem. I don't think we have a plan for what we would do if the Chinese started to move into Southeast Asia. I think we should have a plan, a comprehensive one, a military plan, a political plan, an economic plan. I think that there is some hope here. It may be a very far-fetched hope, that we may have some situations here where our interests cross with the Russians, and it's conceivable that they're frightened of this possible development, as many of us are.
Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. Bowles, you've written that there's a national consensus in this country on foreign policy. Do you still believe that?
Mr. Lissagor, I believe it very deeply, and I've been all over the United States in the last many months, traveling from one end to another, talking to all kinds of people. And I feel an extraordinary feeling of oneness to a degree with all kinds of audiences.
Well, doesn't that bring us down, Mr. Bowles, to the fact that you're really going to vote on personalities then in this election insofar as foreign policy is concerned? Isn't it a question of which man you choose better qualified to lead you?
I hate to disagree when we're so close to the end of this program, but I'll have to disagree with that. I do feel the approaches, what the two parties say they're for are quite similar. They're both for peace, they're for negotiation, they're against colonialism, they're for foreign aid, and so on. But when you begin to examine the way these two parties go after these objectives, you find a tremendous difference. First of all, the Republicans, I think, accept this world of change with great unhappiness. They would like to see everything frozen, if everything only stands still. If only Africa would stand still, and Asia, and Europe, and Asia, Latin America. I think we Democrats recognize that we're in a revolutionary world of great change, enormous potential. that this revolution is not something we should be frightened of. It's something we should welcome, something we should try to influence and positively, creatively push in the directions of greater human dignity. I think there's a tremendous difference here. Emerson once summed it up in saying that wherever there is politics, you'll find people grouping around two ideas, one associated with memory and the other associated with hope. Our party is the party of hope.
Could I be a little more specific? How in do you disagree with Vice President Nixon, basically, on foreign policy?
I think we disagree on approach, largely. I think his approach would be more expedient. I think his military aid program would probably be much more expedient than ours. I think it would be less creative. I think there'd be less emphasis on the initiative. Not necessarily because Mr. Nixon himself feels that way, but after all, he is tied to Mr. Halleck, and I might also say he is tied to Mr. Goldwater, who has been brought already into this particular broadcast. He has to settle with those people.
Gentlemen, I see that our time has run out. I'm sorry to have to interrupt. Thank you very much, Congressman Bowles, for being with us.
And Monitor's thanks to Congressman Chester Bowles and the members of the panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. Our panelists on Meet the Press were Frank Bergholzer of NBC News, Chalmers Roberts of the Washington Post, Peter Lissagor of the Chicago Daily News, and John Steele of Time Life Incorporated. Meet the Press, produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Did you know that 75 million captive people are fighting for freedom by listening to the truth? Yes, right now, millions of people behind the Iron Curtain are caught in a flood of communist propaganda. These people once enjoyed freedom. Today they are shut off from the free world, and can't even get truthful news and information unless you yourself help. How can you help? With the dollars which you send to Crusade for Freedom. Dollars that help keep Radio Free Europe on the air. Help Radio Free Europe to send the truth through the Iron Curtain. Your dollars buy precious minutes of truth for millions of oppressed people behind the Iron Curtain. Your dollars help Radio Free Europe to pay for the technical personnel and the equipment necessary to combat communist lies. Your dollars build the will to resist communist oppression, to keep the spirit of freedom alive in the satellite countries. Remember, it is up to you to answer the call for help from millions of people behind the Iron Curtain. Give the gift of free men and women. Give the truth. The way you can do this is to send your truth dollars for Radio Free Europe today to this simple address, Crusade for Freedom, care of your local postmaster. That's Crusade for Freedom in care of your local postmaster. So saying, I see that once again, time for me on this Monitor Week has run out. I hope we've managed to beguile the time for you. It's our only excuse for throwing our voices against your roof. Parts of the preceding hour were pre-recorded. News follows in a moment. Now this is Ben Grauer saying, I hope you'll join us here again next week. And may the days between be pleasant ones at your house and at mine. And now, good night.
This is Monitor, the NBC Weekend Radio Service.